From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, an inside account of the Tiananmen Square massacre. 30 years ago this month, student protests erupted in Beijing, posing one of the most significant threats to the rule of the Communist Party in China's history. The demonstrations lasted 2 months and grew to include a range of citizens, all demanding reforms in the country.
For the first time in huge numbers, the ordinary men and women of Beijing, the old and the young, professors and taxi drivers, have joined the student protests, lending their support to what has now taken on all the appearances of a peaceful popular uprising against the oppressiveness of communist rule, a campaign for China's renewal in an atmosphere of freedom and democracy.
The focal point of the protest was Tiananmen Square, the heart of Beijing. Within a few weeks, the government declared martial law. And then in early June, the world watched in horror as Chinese military tanks rolled in the streets of Beijing. On the way to Tiananmen Square, they fired indiscriminately at protesters. There were reports of tanks rolling over students.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots.
In the midst of all this chaos was John Pomfret, who covered China for the Associated Press at the time. He had an advantage over his fellow foreign correspondents. He had studied in China, spoke Mandarin fluently, and had many contacts in the student movement. He joins us today. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're coming on the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, but I want to actually start with how you came to China in the first place. How did you come?
So I went to college wanting to study neurophysiology.
Okay.
And I confronted then college chemistry. And as a matriculating freshman, I discovered very rapidly that I had no idea how to study for a chemistry examination at the college level. At the same time, Stanford had a great group of people teaching Chinese-related topics, history, anthropology, sociology, economics, and I started taking Chinese classes, and I did a lot better in my China-related classes than I did on my science-related classes. And at the end of my third year at Stanford, the opportunity arose, and this was in the late 70s, as the United States and China were proceeding towards normalization, the opportunity arose to go to China to study. And from my perspective, the opportunity to go to China at that time was basically probably as close as you could get to going to the moon without leaving the orbit of the Earth. And so I went to China for 2 years, starting from 1980 to 82, and studied there, initially in Beijing and then in Nanjing University. I lived in a 10 by 15 foot room with seven guys for a year and a half. I mean,
and when you say seven guys, seven Chinese men?
Chinese students, yes. Yeah, and the bed was 5'10", and I'm 6'2", so there was that issue. But in terms of a immersion into another culture, it was, from my perspective, unprecedented. At one time during the course of a vacation I had, I spent 55 days without speaking English. I had it noted in my diary.
And what was Beijing like then? What did it feel like?
Everyone was on a bicycle. There were very few cars. There were a lot of donkey carts. You really could get the sense of the enormity of the North China sky. There were no skyscrapers. The Beijing Hotel was the tallest building around, and it was like 15 stories max.
Were you the first Westerner the students you were living with had ever met?
Yes, in Nanjing I was. In Nanjing, it was a city of about 4 million people at the time, and there were 50 Westerners there. That was it. There were several hundred African students, but in terms of developed country people, there were just 50 of us.
And tell me a little bit about this generation. It's a sort of post-cultural revolution generation. Who were they?
So my classmates matriculated in 78, and they were the second class that had been allowed to go to university after Deng Xiaoping basically reopened the universities in 1977. That was the first class. Basically, the average age of the class, the matriculating freshman class, was about 25 years old. Most of them were sent down youth. Basically, they had been, during the Cultural Revolution, preparing to go to high school when all the high schools were shut in the urban areas, and millions of these youth were sent down by Chairman Mao to the countryside to learn from the peasantry. And they effectively had never had a day of high school. And so in the months running up to Deng's decision to reopen universities, they all began to cram for the university entrance test. And so there was a test given in December of 76, and then basically the schools were reopened in 77, and they were allowed to come. And this was the second group that had come. And so these people were extremely hungry. I mean, they were passionate about studying, and they understood that a university degree was going to fundamentally change their lives. And they had thought their lives were basically over, right? And they had sent to the countryside. They had no idea whether they were going to be able to leave or not. But Deng gave them a way out. And ultimately, they really changed not only their lives, but of course, China writ large.
Was there any kind of culture of dissidence?
There was a culture of not believing the party. And so they had been told, of course, that America was effectively the great Satan, to borrow an expression from Iran. And anything that had gone on in the United States was bogus. And for example, the United States had never even gone to the moon. That was just fake news. And Americans lived in a horribly repressive society where there was lots of exploitation and there was no freedom in the United States. That was fake news as well. And they didn't believe any of that propaganda. And so the curiosity about life in the United States was overwhelming. And every night, pretty much, I was grilled by my classmates about different aspects of American society just because they had been taught to believe A, but they just almost, in a knee-jerk way, didn't believe A, so they wanted to know what the quote-unquote real story was.
So you finished school in the early 80s. Did you go back to the U.S. at that point?
Yeah, I went to France and then back to the States to finish my degree.
What brought you back to China?
I was basically passionate about potential changes in China. And then Nate Palowetsky was the late great editor, foreign editor of the AP, hired me onto the foreign staff. And after a couple of years on the desk there, he sent me to China in 88.
So 88, you're sort of on the cusp of this major revolutionary moment. What was the trigger for April 1989?
So there was a lot of stuff percolating in China at the time. So there had been a whole series of student demonstrations in the mid-80s that had been repressed, but not violently repressed. They'd just been kind of cracked down on, but with no bloodshed. Some arrests, but no bloodshed. What was happening was that growth had started. The peasantry had effectively been liberated from their communes, and so they started to make more money in the countryside. And then in the cities, the government had in some areas begun to release prices because in the past, because of the communist market economy, all prices had been controlled. And so they began to release prices. And so what happened was that people who had access to state-set prices, which were lower, could take product and then turn around and resell it onto the open market at the open market prices, which were a lot higher. And those people who had access to that type of price differential were almost always the sons and daughters of Communist Party officials. And so in a situation where inflation is rising, prices are going up because the peasantry are starting to make money, so food prices are going up. People in the urban areas saw this really unfair system evolving and got pretty angry about it. And so this is happening at the same time you have the country opening up to Western influences, opening up to Western ideas. And it was this marriage between significant discontent in the lower levels of society with an opening of minds among the elite, among the student population. And that created the potential for real instability. At the same time, you also had within the party different factions jockeying for positions, one faction who believed in faster economic reforms and more westernization, and another faction that really opposed that as well. So you had all the raw materials for real problems going from 88 to 89.
Students start to gather and lobby for the ability to gather without being monitored by the party. How do they do that? I mean, are they watched over? How does that happen?
So what was starting in as early as 88, in fact, even earlier than that, but 88 was really the beginning, was that people wanted to form organizations that were not under the control of the Communist Party. Because one of the issues in China was that the party controlled everything, and there was no such thing as a right to organize. Freedom of association is not part of the Chinese Communist Party platform. And the students, basically, that was a main demand, that the student unions would not be run by the party. And so in universities such as Beijing University, Tsinghua University, Nanjing University, Fudan, which is another major university in Shanghai, students began to have these natural organizations formed and have these basically democracies, what they called salons, where Chinese liberals were invited to speak about democratization process, about freedom of association and other freedoms, the U.S. Bill of Rights, Statue of Liberty, the history of democracy in the West. And this type of interaction between Chinese students and some Chinese liberals really intensified 88 into 89. And the trigger, of course, for the demonstrations was the death of the party secretary by the name of Hu Yaobang, who died in April of 1989 and who was somewhat of a symbol for westernizers in China. He is a guy who basically came out against chopsticks. He said using a knife and fork was more efficient. But he also was very important in rehabilitating hundreds of thousands of Chinese intellectuals who'd been purged during the anti-rightist campaign in the mid-50s, but also the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976.
And how did you have access to them? I mean, did you already know people from when you were studying in China? Did you have greater access?
So I had lived in a Chinese dormitory for a year and a half. And so when I went into these dormitories, I kind of felt like I was home. And that, I think, perhaps subconsciously resonated with the people there. I mean, I would like sit on their beds and kind of hang out like I hung out in my own dorm room 6 or 7 years before. So and I was a little bit younger and I spoke pretty decent Chinese. And I just kind of realized that they were like my classmates, a later generation, but they were very similar to my classmates. Their rooms looked, and I think more importantly, smelled like the room I lived in Nanjing University for a year and a half. And for me, it wasn't as exotic as it probably appeared to many other Western correspondents who hadn't had that experience.
When you say they were a later generation, the students that you described earlier are actually were plucked back out of this countryside and given the chance to go to school. Were these students who had expected to go to school?
Yeah, these were students, generally speaking, who had gone through high school. So this is just their life experience is significantly different from the life experience from their elders.
And describe the energy of these meetings, these early meetings on campus.
It was just full of this sense of possibility and a real search for a new set of values for their country. A lot of patriotism, deep love of their country, and deep desire in the sense of what direction are we going to take and that anything is possible. That was the overriding sense you got was of optimism about what China could do and where China could go.
But at first, there are marches and that are pretty quiet. Describe the early days of demonstrations in April of 89.
So relatively quickly, it begins to coalesce near Tiananmen Square. I'm actually the front gates of Zhongnanhai, which is the Communist Party headquarters, which is just off the square along the Gate of Heavenly Peace, which leads into the Forbidden City. But very boisterous, humorous, a lot of humor, which is something that the Communist Party always has had a difficulty dealing with. I remember one of the very charismatic leaders, this fellow named Wu Kaixi, who was of Uyghur extraction, just being a master behind the bullhorn, at being able to whip up a crowd, but to do so in a humorous way that almost like a carnival barker, a Pied Piper in a way. And it was that sense of youth, sort of shaggy, over-the-collar hair, wearing workers' clothing, this kind of a proletarian chic happening there. But the sensuality of the whole thing was really extraordinary.
It sounds like, though you said you didn't exoticize it because it had become very much a norm to you, that it was romantic in some ways.
Oh, it was completely romantic. You know, and I was 30 years old, so I was still capable of of romantic thoughts. But yeah, it was extreme. I mean, especially as the protests got larger, I mean, there were some points where I was in the northwest of the city, which was where all the universities were concentrated, and in a crowd that would push through police barriers. And the fact that the police gave way, it really gave you a sense that, okay, even the security structures here are somewhat sympathetic to the goals of the student movement. And then other moments of standing on pedestrian overpasses and looking in all directions along these massive boulevards, north, south, east, and west, and see them being filled with nothing but people carrying banners calling for more freedom and a better China.
Where are the people coming from as the crowds get larger? It starts out with Beijing students, but who comes in?
So it starts out with Beijing students, and then it starts getting a lot more worker participation, and then the participation of newspapers, in some cases even security services, factories, white-collar workers, bankers. So you get a real collection of, like, Beijing intelligentsia, if you will, and white-collar representation as well.
What's the request of the demonstrators? First, you said they were looking for freedom of assembly, but does it shift?
Yeah, it begins to shift in May, especially after a series of very hardline editorials appear in the People's Daily, accusing them of counter-revolutionary turmoil and questioning their patriotism. And so then the tenor of the demonstration shifts to a much more aggressive sort of anti-hardline view. There are calls for Li Peng, who was the premier at the time and is considered one of the toughest Chinese officials at that period, for him to step down. Some people even criticized Deng Xiaoping, who was the mastermind of Chinese economic reforms. So it becomes more aggressive. And generally speaking, though, the requests of the demonstrators or their demands were a bit opaque and murky. I don't think they even knew in many cases what they wanted. They kind of knew that they wanted a freer country, less corruption, more rights. And also, if you looked, I mean, there were issues, of course, among the protesters and within the protest movement from the start, because many of these people had never had an experience living in a more pluralistic society. They often embraced some of the values of the, you know, the Communist Party as they carried out their work. And so within the student organization that they'd established, there was almost like a Leninist party structure where they would broke no dissent amongst other students. But that said, I don't think that should kind of take away from the genuineness of their desire for a more free society.
And there's a hunger strike at the beginning of May.
There is. And so partially because they feel that they're not being recognized by the party state as patriotic. I mean, a lot of this had to do with who was more patriotic. And so the party state really increasingly, as time passes, tries to paint them as pawns of the West and pawns of people who do not wish China well and pawns of anti-Chinese or anti-revolutionary clique. They then push back against that to show that they love China and that they're willing to stop eating for their country. And there's this major, effectively, competition between the party state, which dominates, of course, all the media, and the students over who is kind of, if you will, more Chinese.
So there are appeals for the hunger strike to end, and eventually it does. But then things take a darker turn and martial law is imposed.
So martial law is imposed, and there's a real sense that the crackdown is going to come. That said, you know, the PLA begins to mobilize, but the mobilization is done slowly.
Explain what the PLA is.
The PLA is the People's Liberation Army. It's China's military. And China at the time didn't really have riot police. It basically had police, and then it had the military. Only after the Tiananmen Square crackdown did they create what they call the People's Armed Police, which are effectively the anti-riot forces, which they have now. But then they just had the army, and the army was deployed around Beijing. And within the military, there was significant opposition to deploying around Beijing. And some people were moved out of important positions. Military commanders were fired. Ultimately, some might have actually been jailed. But that said, the bulk of the military followed orders, and they began to mobilize and move towards Beijing.
You're actually on the scene when there's an actual crackdown. I mean, it's not just martial law has been imposed, but that the soldiers who are watching the protesters begin to move in and beat protesters and fire on them with live ammunition. Can you describe what happens?
Yeah, so on the evening of June 3rd, I had dinner with a friend in a western part of Beijing, along the main boulevard that leads into Tiananmen Square. And after dinner, we walked outside and basically kind of taking the air The Chinese have an expression that 100 steps after dinner will allow you to live to the age of 99. So we were taking our 100 steps. And while we were downstairs, we were walking relatively near the Military Museum and the Ministry of Defense. And from the Military Museum and the Ministry of Defense, from that compound, emerge a whole line of armored personnel carriers. And they head towards this small overpass, which is now a major overpass, but it was a small overpass then, going over a creek. And on that overpass, people had placed buses in order to stop any potential military incursion into the city. They were, you know, blocking the way. And the APCs began to ram the buses to get them out of the way. And at that moment, a bunch of ground troops came out as well and began to fire, I think, initially in the air. But very soon, the crowd began to throw rocks and bricks at the military, and they then began to fire into the crowd. And I happened to be there.
Are you filing stories for the AP while you're watching this?
Yeah, I had a cell phone that was about as big as a relatively hefty-sized loaf of bread. But the cell phone system continued to work. And so throughout the evening, when the shooting began, I filed. I just was basically calling in to Jim Abrams, who was the AP bureau chief at the time, just calling in, telling him what I saw, up until about 3:30 to 4 a.m. the next morning. So as the firing happened, several occasions I was literally, you know, I hit the dirt. I was on the ground. There were some people falling near me. And then after the troops broke through the barriers of these buses, they began to proceed from west to east down towards the square. And I had my bicycle with me, so I began to kind of parallel their invasion, if you will, of the center of the city by riding on alleyways that were just a little bit north of the main boulevard.
You keep yourself with the students eventually and you enter the square. Are you trapped there with them?
Yeah, basically I kind of come into the square from the east. And basically the PLA were coming from the south and they were coming from the west, but they'd left the east open so they could push people out that way. You know, they didn't intend on locking everybody in the square and then killing them all. That was, I don't think, their goals. As they entered towards the square, they killed people. But once they were in the square, we don't really have any evidence of anyone actually dying in the square. And so I found myself in the square, and I'm like, great, I'm in the square, I've made it. And then I'm like, oh, you idiot, now you're trapped. And indeed we were. And everyone was coalescing. In Tiananmen Square, there's a large obelisk, and we were all collected around that tower. There were some 400 of us at the time.
And meanwhile, had you seen, I mean, you said they weren't trying to kill people in the square, but along the way, do you see people fall? Do you see blood? What do you see?
I saw an armored personnel carrier on fire because it had been attacked by a Molotov cocktail. And I saw bodies on the street of protesters who had been trying to stop the army from rolling into the center of the city.
So here you are in the square. Are you still phoning in your reports?
Yes.
Are you scared?
I'd never seen gunshot fire in anger. After that, I subsequently spent 8 years in war zones. Only later did I realize that actually bullets came relatively close to me, because if you hear a crack of a bullet, not just a whiz, but a crack, the bullet's actually relatively close to your head. And I didn't know that before. I just thought it was sounded like firecrackers to me. But obviously, it turns out later on, I was in Bosnia for 4 years after that, and I was like, oh my goodness, that was actually the closest I've ever come to being shot. But I didn't know it at the time. So sometimes ignorance is bliss. It's just, I was so focused on like simple logistical things, like I hope my bike doesn't break, I hope my cell phone continues to work, what's happening next? You're in kind of this work mode.
How did you get out of the square?
So there was a negotiations between a group of self-appointed leaders of the movement, including a Taiwanese rock star by the name of Hou Dejian and several others, who basically came to the conclusion that if this group of 300, 400 people didn't leave, they were going to get massacred. And so they began to have negotiations with representatives from the People's Liberation Army. And it was agreed that about 3:30 to 4:30 a.m., sometime around then, that they would be given safe passage to go. And once the negotiations were finished, they came back to the Revolutionary Martyrs Obelisk and they asked everybody, should we leave? Let's do it by a voice vote. And so when they said, should we leave? Everyone said, no, and screamed very loudly. And then they said, okay, who wants to leave? And only a few people said yes. And they said, well, the people who want to leave have won, so let's leave. In the end, most people came around. And actually, everyone came around, and we were allowed to walk out.
You go home, you go back to the office, but then you're actually called in by the state police.
Yeah, this was 2 weeks later.
Okay.
About 2 weeks later, after the crackdown was in full swing. People were being arrested. I was basically, interrogated for a couple of hours by two people who identified themselves as police officers.
Let me go back a moment then, because 2 weeks pass in between, and there's a famous image of Tiananmen, of what came to be known as Tank Man.
Right.
What is the global response during that two-week period?
Well, the global response was, at least within the developed world, the Western world, was shock, complete and utter shock at the Chinese doing this. Now, the political response on the part of the George H.W. Bush administration was a certain amount of shock, but at the same time, we need to do everything we can to maintain a good relationship with China. And that was basically the idea. And part of the reason was still very much this realpolitik perspective that China was important to us as a bulwark against the rapidly changing Soviet Union. And so actually in the run-up to the Tiananmen Square crackdown, Gorbachev goes to China. And the United States government at the time was so obsessed with Gorbachev kind of peeling the Chinese away from us that it didn't spend enough time, that much time and effort, focusing on what was really happening in Beijing. And they spent a lot more time focusing on the realpolitik issues of our competition with Russia vis-a-vis China.
So there's this global response taking place, but you actually have personal contacts among these student leaders that have become friends. And when you're called in by the police, they start asking you about them.
Right. Yeah. They were very interested in relationships that I had with people who had been either directly or indirectly involved in the movement. And I had, become very close to Warwick Heisey, the fellow that I talked about, who was a master with a bullhorn. And actually, at one point in the middle of the student hunger strike, he'd called me for a meeting, a very, very late night meeting. It was around 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. And he got into my car and he said, okay, this meeting's off the record, okay? And I said, yes, it's off the record. He's like, I'm not going to tell anything about what happened in the meeting. I said, I won't. He said, great, you got to get me some noodles. I'm starving. And so I was directly responsible for violating the hunger strike provisions. And later on, I was criticized for it as being somehow of a participant in the movement. And it was difficult because he was an incredibly good source. And so, clearly in these type of moments, which are so romantic, as you said earlier, you get caught up and your loyalties, even though you're not supposed to be loyal to one side or the other, your loyalties get, your heartstrings get pulled. So when the crackdown happened, I had been contacted by Warwick Heisey in particular, who was desperate to leave China. And I had, no way to get him out, but I had huge sympathy for those people and for their desires to leave their country. And Warwick Heisey made it out, whereas other people like Wang Dan did not, who was arrested and thrown in jail. He now lives in Taiwan.
How long was he in jail?
He was in jail, I think, for close to 10 years.
In your book, you mentioned that you live with great guilt that he is jailed and that you may have played some role in that.
That was another person.
So who are we speaking about there?
So this gentleman was an officer in the Cultural Division of the People's Liberation Army, and he was very helpful to me in sort of giving me a sense of what was happening within the military. I'd met with him during the protest, and I didn't know, but I should have assumed, and I was foolish not to, that everything that we were communicating between each other was being monitored either through directional microphones or just by simply tailing us. And so during my interrogation, my interrogators asked me about my relationship with this gentleman. And I said I knew him, but the only thing we discussed was girls and jazz. He was a great aficionado of jazz. The officer in question was then ultimately sentenced to 2.5 years in prison and was released, and later on actually had a very successful career as a composer. But nonetheless, my association with him was directly related to his incarceration. And then at the end of this interrogation, they kind of labeled me both unfriendly and uncooperative, at which point they ordered me expelled from China. They gave me 3 days to leave.
You do leave China at that point?
Yes, I leave China after I was expelled, yes.
And how long are you not allowed back into China?
I transferred down to the APS Bureau in Hong Kong, and I was allowed back in 90 and 91 on short trips to southern China. And then I don't involve myself with China until 96, when an opening happens in the Beijing Bureau and the Post puts my name in. And Mrs. Catherine Graham used her connections with Henry Kissinger to get Dr. Kissinger to lobby on my behalf. And that was successful. So the Chinese let me back in, and then I served there for the Post until 2003.
How do you think the experience of April 1989 informs Beijing today?
That's something I've thought about a lot. And I think what it really did was before that was happening, China was really on a trajectory under which the party was going to have an increasingly small amount of influence over the course of the country, and the government was becoming a lot stronger. And I think Tiananmen Square stopped that process, and it kind of was a stasis for a while. But I think Xi Jinping from 2012 is really bringing it to its logical conclusion, where he's so gutting the government and he's so strengthening the party. And I think that process was a process that was basically hijacked in 89, and it's continued. And now it's on steroids right now. And so the government has a lot less input into how the country operates, and it's become pretty much a 100% party-run country.
What about the way the U.S. relates to China and how we address or don't address human rights?
So I think that after the Tiananmen Square crackdown, and particularly from 92 on, when China basically resumed its economic reforms, there was a narrative in the States that was stoked, obviously, by America's political class to say that, well, China had this great human rights tragedy in the late 80s, and China has, you know, questionable human rights practices now, but just wait, because with time, you know, once the Chinese begin to be able to choose between Coke and Pepsi, they're going to want to choose their leaders. And, you know, that was sort of the simplistic version of it. But it was this idea that with time and with trade, China's naturally going to become a more pluralistic society. But I think now there's a general recognition that that calculus has basically collapsed completely, and that China's going in a direction that many people within the United States government and U.S. society find objectionable. And so it's not worked out the way we thought it was going to. And so part of the confusion you see in the Trump administration is not simply Trump. It's just the fact that it's a really difficult thing to do to create a new policy when the old policy of engagement has in many cases failed. In some cases, it's obviously been successful, but in other cases, it's failed.
Do you have any other thoughts about what the legacy of Tiananmen is?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's 30 years, right? And so the median age of China right now is 38. So a significant number of Chinese were not born when Tiananmen Square was happening. And the Chinese government has been extremely successful at wiping out any recollection of the ideas of the movement and any recollection of actually, you know, what happened. And so there's this remarkable documentary, The Tank Man, where they show pictures of the tank man to whom you referred earlier to Beijing University students that are like, what's this? Is the guy doing performance art? What is this? They have no idea of those images and of the importance that those images had to their country back in the day. And so the question is, if, you know, something is wiped out so successfully, will it ever have any resonance again amongst the people of China? I don't know. I think it probably will. At a certain point, there has to be a reevaluation of this. But people have thought it was going to happen a lot earlier than it has so far, and it hasn't happened yet. The Chinese party state has a remarkable ability to really manipulate the minds of people in China, still to this day.
John, I want to thank you for coming on today to talk about the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Sarah.
John Pomfret is a former reporter for the Associated Press and the Washington Post. He's also the author of the book, The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the Present. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host.